David and I were in law school, we had a professor, Bill Schultz. William Schultz, he was very kind of Germanic looking, handsome, tall, blonde man, looked like a Nazi officer. And he was very, he used to, do you want me to stop?
No, go ahead.
He used to comment, David and I were of course the only husband and wife in the law school, and we used to walk around arm in arm. We walked around arm in arm here in town all the time with our arms around each other. But Bill Schultz used to always talk about how sweet it was to see David and me together, you know, in the halls and so forth. And he became kind of personally friendly with us. He was a very nice man. Well, it turned out Bill Schultz was active in the American Civil Liberties Union, which I had never even heard of, or maybe I knew, but I had heard the initials. And I was about to graduate from law school, and Bill Schultz and another professor there, Harry Foster, who later went to NYU, called me into the office, and they say to me, you know, I had had, Bill gave me a very good grade in this course, and I mean, they were pleased with my academic achievement, and Bill and Harry said to me, you know, you really ought to consider becoming active in this organization. Well, what's the organization? Well, the ACLU, Harry Foster had a fantastic collection of books on constitutional law and First Amendment, free speech, and I had admired those. And we could, when you get out, as soon as you pass the bar exam, you could be counsel for them. Now, you understand this is a free job. It's a non-paying job. Mm-hmm. And, oh, well, I could be counsel, you know, I'm just getting out. I didn't, it was hardly active at all. It was not really much of a chapter. There was a chapter. Yeah. At any event, I agreed, and that's how I started with the ACLU. They entrapped me right out of law school. and it was a wonderful experience. David loved the ACLU as well, but he was never active in it. I was more, David was not an organization kind of person. He didn't like to go to meetings. He
wasn't a groupie.
He was not a groupie at all. But I started with the ACLU, and I did represent them in a number of cases, mm-hmm. including representing the American Nazi Party.
You represented them?
I remember the, represented the
Was
American
that the
Nazi
Chicago?
Party. No, Skokie. No. Here, they came here, and they were denied a permit. They were violating the law, and I represented them, and I remember Cyril Weck saying to me, sure, you'll be going off to the gas chamber saying, I'm going to defend their right to say what they want. My father was not very happy. David was totally supportive, because when it came up, I was the person who was counsel for the ACLU,
right.
And I discussed it with him as to what he thought I ought to do. Because what was happening was they were being denied the right to speak. It was a clear violation of their First Amendment rights, and I believe that fervently. And David said, there's not even any question. Of course, you have to represent them. But in terms of the ACLU, I have stayed active in it all through the years. I've been a member of the Pittsburgh Board since I graduated from law school. I've served as their counsel. I've been volunteer counsel in many cases, culminating, I guess, in the one of the most thrilling cases I ever had, which was the opportunity to try and argue the case of ACLU versus Allegheny County.
I have that down here.
And I will tell you about that because it gave me an opportunity to argue in the United States Supreme Court. We didn't discuss this the last time we spoke.
No, we haven't touched on any of this.
Well, the other case we really should talk about that my husband
Continental Can and Connie Hawkins. I've
Connie,
got him
Connie
down.
Hawkins.
That's what I'm
Connie
here
Hawkins.
To.
The ACLU case culminated in 1989. It started a couple of years before that when the ACLU decided that it was going to bring an action to try to enjoin the use of a very, very religious appearing creche at the county courthouse, right on the grand staircase of the courthouse. And for many years, the county commissioner, Commissioner Forrester, had allowed discretion, I really fostered it and encouraged discretion to be put up by the Holy Name Society. And it was a creche that was so reverent that one could easily imagine its being in a church. Mm-hmm. We had a priest as a witness who said it's indistinguishable from the kind of creches we have at the Christmases. And at that time, when we brought the suit, we brought a suit to enjoin the use of this creche in the courthouse, which is where the county commissioner's office is, where the treasurer's office was, criminal courts were there, people going into this important government building were accosted on the main staircase by this very large, reverent creche, which was adorned by an angel, and you know, had all the reverent figures, and the quote from the Gospels. And at the same time, they had started the tradition of the menorah at the city council. We thought that was equally improper, and so we brought suit to enjoin both of them. Unfortunately, we didn't get to develop the menorah case as well, in retrospect, as I would have liked to, but we tried these cases. I tried them in the district court, and I argued them in the circuit. In the district court, we lost. In the circuit, we got an injunction against both of them, and then the other sides appealed to the United States Supreme Court. And I got to argue that case, which was just a thrilling experience. Now, fortunately, I was able to devote just inordinate amounts of time to preparation because I wanted to be positive that I was going to do as good a job as anybody could do. I care fervently about the separation of church and state. I think it's a really, really important thing for everybody, but I think it's particularly important for Jews.
No question about it.
And I think one of the sad things to me was that a Jewish group was in fostering the use of the menorah, which had been proclaimed by the Rebbe Schneerson, as being an important thing to do, that they encouraged the use of the creche. And I heard their lawyer stand up at the Supreme Court and be asked, well, how do you feel about the creche on government property? And he had to in order to take a consistent position with the menorah. But in any event, I argued that case and one of the joys of it was I was very well prepared, so it was thrilling because I knew that I really was on top of everything. It was a marvelous experience. Just about every justice was asking questions. Everybody was joining in. But maybe most thrilling of all was our son Harry at that time was a law clerk in the United States.
Thurgood Marshall.
No, it wasn't for Thurgood Marshall. He had clerked for Thurgood Marshall the year before, but a very unusual thing happened. Justice Kennedy had come on the court, and he asked three clerks, one who clerked for Justice Scalia, one for Justice White, and one for Thurgood Marshall, which was kind of, Harry was the only, quote, lib, close quote,
right,
who he had, to come and serve as his clerks. So I not only had to be good enough to impress the nine justices, including my son's boss, Justice Kennedy, but I had to be good enough so that all these law clerks who are lined up along the left-hand side as you go into the court, you know, I wouldn't embarrass my son.
Right.
And I walked in and I saw all these law clerks sitting over there.
What an exciting.
Oh, it was wonderful.
It must have been incredible.
It was wonderful. It really was wonderful.
Oh, my.
And I mean, it was just really a joy and a privilege.
And you won.
And I won. Well, I we didn't get the menorah thrown out, but we did get the creche
and joy.
No. They said that on the facts as they were, that it was part of a larger display, and they did not enjoin it. Although if I had it to do over again, I would have developed testimony about some of the religious observances that went on there with the lighting and so forth. That wasn't part of the record. However, at ACLU versus Allegheny County is not only still good law, it's the principal case on which the court relies. So that was a wonderful experience. The ACLU has been a really, really enriching part of my life. The National Board is a wonderful organization. It's a privilege to serve on. The people who are on it are just remarkable, intelligent, articulate people, and it's just a joy.
I think it's a wonderful thing you do. From the bottom of my heart, I do.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say.
I do feel that way.
And David
was... Give of yourself to that organization for freedom.
I feel that it's the most important organization in the United States. Nobody else does what they do. And, you know, we have, the ACLU has more cases in the United States Supreme Court than anyone except the United States government. And it's a small organization. It has only about 250,000 members. And, I mean, just think what it does for that.
It's our greatest protection.
And I'm devoted to that organization. And David was just always so supportive of my having to take time off to go to the meetings. He used to go often with me. He loved New York, and he loved the theater, and he loved restaurants, and he loved to walk in New York. And I'd go to these meetings. They'd meet from early in the morning Saturday till 6 o'clock at night, and then it used to be 8 o'clock Sunday morning till 2 o'clock. And he used to come to New York, and all during that time I'd be at the meetings, and he'd walk from one end of the city to the other. And every once in a while I'd turn around, and he was there, and he was sitting, and he was listening, you know, to the debate. I mean, I don't think that anyone in our family, including our kids, really knew how much he appreciated and loved that organization. And he never, you know, what we talk about, how much should we donate, and he never objected to anything we gave him. He really loved it.
He gave us a full heart.
Yes, he did. So that was that. Okay. But the biggie case was Connie Hawkins.
Okay.
Connie Hawkins was a gifted, beautiful basketball player who had been raised in the Bedford-Stuyvesant district of Brooklyn, and who had been such an outstanding basketball player that he was known all over New York. He was a legend. He played not only for boys' high school, but at that time in the playgrounds in New York. And when he was 18, his high school education was just totally neglected. He was basically illiterate. I mean, they didn't care about educating him. They cared about his playing basketball.
Kind of a classic case.
Classic case. And he was such a fine young man. He was raised in a family where his father was not part of the household. He was one of a number of children. His mother worked as a domestic. He was inordinately tall and slept in the same bed as his brother. I mean, he had a very deprived childhood, and then suddenly found himself as a senior in high school being whined and dined by all of these college representatives who used to come in, take him out and buy them steak dinners, talk to his family, slip them little things under the table, which you're not allowed to do according to the rules of the sports organizations, but they were honored in ignoring them. And what they would do is take these kids and wind them and dine them so that they would go to this school, that school, the other school. Well, Connie wound up going to Iowa State, and he was in his freshman year. He had never played college basketball because they never played against other teams until their sophomore year. He only played intercollegiate ball, no varsity ball. When in New York there broke a basketball scandal. Now that had been the second basketball scandal, a point shaving scandal, whereby people were engaged with a couple of guys, one of whom had been a very famous Jewish basketball player named Jack Molinas, who was a lawyer and a very, very smart man. David and I later met him, of course, in this case, who just couldn't do it straight. He had to do it wheeler dealer and by some method. And there were these two guys who ran this basketball fix through. They'd go to players who were playing varsity ball, and they'd get the cachet points, and then they'd make money by the betting, right, and by working with the gamblers. Well, as I said, Connie had never played varsity ball, but he'd been raised on the streets in New York, and in his junior and senior year, one of the guys he'd met in the playground, who was a very fine basketball player, who played for the Detroit Pistons, was this guy Jack Bolinas. And Jack Bolinas befriended Connie and another young player, without a doubt thinking in future years he's going to remember that I was nice to him, and when the time comes I'm going to approach him. But those future years had never even come to pass. And so Jack Bolinas, actually it was Roger Brown more than Connie, did things like he lent them his car if they had to go somewhere, and they thought that was great. He took them out a couple of times and bought them steak dinners. But you see, Connie was experiencing that with all these other people who'd come from all these schools, right. So he never thought anything unusual about that. And he was just very naive. It never occurred to him that anybody might in future years be trying to set him up. And that was about his exposure to Jack Bolinas when, in the course of his first year, there he was away at school.
As a freshman.
Okay. A detective from the New York District Attorney's Office came out to Iowa State, talked to Connie's coach, and said they wanted to have Connie come back to New York to testify at a grand jury hearing that's looking into point shaving. And instead of trying to protect this young man, or instead of trying to say maybe there should be a lawyer, instead of doing anything, they were just, the NBA, the National Basketball Association, was so powerful, and it had such a monopoly going, and the district attorney's office in New York was so strong in doing whatever they wanted to, that these schools just kind of got frightened. They were afraid. They were doing all these shady things with having their scouts go around. They were scared to death of being tainted, and so instead of protecting him, he told Connie, well, I think you should go with him. So Connie went with the clothes on his back, with this detective, and they took him back to New York and confined him in a hotel room where they had all of these players, most of whom, almost all of whom, were involved in point shaving in the hotel. Connie asked to call his mother. They wouldn't let him. I mean, they kept him there for 5 or 6 or 7 days, continuing to ask him, you know, did you ever do this? Well, they knew he couldn't shave points. I mean, they learned that. Did you ever introduce Jack Bolinas to anybody? No. Did he ever ask you to? And I think the most that it ever happened was, well, he asked me if I knew somebody Wilkerson, and Wilkie Gilmore. Did I know Wilkie Gilmore? And I told him, yeah, I know Wilkie Gilmore. And, well, did you ever introduce him? And he said, you know, no, I never introduced him. I think I called Wilkie Gilmore. Well, did you know why he wanted to meet him? And he said, well, no, I just, you know, he liked basketball players, and he had these teams. Anyway, all Connie ever did was, he testified, they were terrible to him. And it turned out that everyone who was ever called in to testify in the grand jury, their names were published in the sports magazines. They were banned. We later learned, don't let the NBA deny it, they were banned for life from playing in the NBA.
Oh, my.
Not only, and he didn't know that.
No.
He got done, he was 19 years old, he went back to school to see his coach, thinking he was going to pick up his life where he left it, and they told him he couldn't stay at school. They sent home this 19-year-old kid whose life had been such an opportunity and a joy, and like that, one of the great basketball players of all time, and that was the end of his life. He went back to Bedford Stuyvesant. And it's quite remarkable that he didn't, you know, he was in a neighborhood where people took drugs, sold drugs, pushed everything. He didn't fall into that kind of life at all. And fortunately for him, he was crushed. It was so sad. It was horrible. Fortunately for him, a new league started. It didn't last very long, but a new basketball league started. And David and his brothers owned the franchise for Pittsburgh.
Okay.
The Wrens, it was called.
Mm.
And Leonard Littman, David's older brother had heard of Connie Hoffman, mm-hmm. and he went to New York to meet him and brought this kid back here. And he began to play in this league. Well, we got to know him. David and I were friendly with the team, and our kids knew all the players, and we used to go to the games. It was really, really fun. First time we ever saw Connie, we saw this beautiful, wide-eyed, graceful, skinny, tall, 6'8" or 9", looking like a racehorse galloping down the field with huge hands. He could hold a couple of basketballs in. And he was just a joy to behold. You didn't have to know very much about basketball to see that he had most beautiful moves. And we began to become friendly with Connie. He was very shy, but very charming. And he was, of course, the star of the team. Because he was, even though he was 4, 5, and 10 years younger than the other people on it, I think he was just heads and shoulders above everybody in his talent. And David had to represent him, because when he began to play, he was so good, then some of the owners began to complain, well, wasn't he involved in this basketball scandal? And so David went to Chicago with him. The guy who was the head of the league was a guy named Abe Saperstein, who owned the Harlem Globetrotters. David had to go represent him there. And, you know, we just all assumed that he had been involved in something illegal. I mean, we just assumed that that was the case. And I remember after we knew him for a while, David said to me one night, you know, I think it's possible that this kid never did anything wrong and that he just has been, you know, unfairly accused. And it took some time, because Connie never talked about that. It had been such a hurtful experience. But really, because of David, we began to talk. Connie became almost a member of the family. When we lived on Woodlawn Street, he used to come over and spend time. And we learned a lot about his way of life. I had never been friendly with any black people before. Connie used to invite us. David and I were the only people. Well, because we were, David was the baby in his family, so there was a big difference in age. And we used to go to the basketball player parties, and they were fun. They were great. Marvelous parties, and we began to talk to Connie, and it turned out that really he had been very unfairly accused. And so David undertook to talk to Connie about it, and asked Connie if Connie would like him to try to do something about it. Of course, Connie was just overwhelmed that somebody would be willing to help him after he'd been so totally rejected and shunned. I don't know that it was so easy for him to trust somebody from the white community after what they had done to him. But David undertook to investigate that case, and he did it at his expense. He didn't have our firm pay for any of the expenses, but he took the money out of his pocket, and he went into New York, and he managed to meet with this Jack Malinas, who was in jail at the time. And I remember he came back and told me, we were in New York, came back and told me about meeting with Jack Malinas. He said, you wouldn't believe it. This guy has a setup. He's got like an office there. It was in the Tombs. That was the jail in New York. And he's running this and he's running that, and he's betting on things, and he's buying stocks. And he said to me, he had to go back and see him again. He says that he'd like to come out and have dinner with us. I said, well, what do you mean come out and have dinner with us? Guy was in jail.
Get out of jail and come and have dinner.
And he said, I'm telling you, he says he can arrange to have dinner with us. Well, we went to an elegant French restaurant on 55th Street. I can't remember the name of it. It was a really fine French restaurant. David and I are there, and he says, this guy's going to meet us. And sure enough, this car pulls up, and out comes Jack Malinas with a date, very kind of flashy lady. They came in, and there were detectives or something sitting in the car. They waited for them outside, and Jack Malinas came in and had dinner for them. Anyway, David, because of his background and his street smarts, was able to talk to these people and appeal to them and get them to have confidence in him and respond to him in a way that I think most people I knew could not have done. And Indeed, Jack Molinas affirmed for David, and we had a written statement and an affidavit that Connie had never done anything wrong. Not that he hadn't planned to ask him to in a couple of years, mm-hmm. but he was still trying to sow the seeds. Mm-hmm. And David went from there up to another prison, up in it was not Sing Sing, Wallkill, I think it was, up in upstate New York. He took the train, he went up and he met with the other guy who had been the mastermind, a guy by the name of Joey Hacken, who masterminded this thing together with Jack Molinas. David became very fond of Joey Hacken, who had a conscience and the morality to say that he really felt very bad about Connie, and he would be happy to help if he could, because it really wasn't fair. But most of the guys they had banned had done things that were wrong.
But not Connie.
But Connie hadn't. Not that they hadn't intended to try in future years, but that it was so unfair. And so David got a statement from him, and then he went, this player that they had insisted Connie introduce to Jack Molinas, the Smokey Gilmore, David found him up in Connecticut, and he went up there, and he got statements from him, and finally he did all this investigation. Oh, and he started off, in order to research this, I remember he called David loved certain sports, and he loved good sports writers, and he called this wonderful sports writer from the New York Post, who had once written an article saying how unfairly Connie had been treated. Milt Gross, his name was, and David called him and told him he was trying to help him. He was a lawyer, he'd like to help him. And Milt Gross opened up the paper's morgue to David so that David could read, and that's where he learned all about what had gone on and the grand jury investigation. Well, by that time, it was 1966, and David felt that there was a shot at a case, and so we came to the firm, and you know, by that time we had a couple of other associates and so said, I really think if the firm wants to take this on a contingent basis, I think there's a shot at winning. Now, nobody had ever won an antitrust case like this against the sports league. In fact, the law was to the contrary. But we thought maybe we could do it. And so we did. We undertook that case. And it was just a thrilling thing, because David had done all the investigation stuff, and then I did the legal stuff. And the law firm who represented the NBA was a large law firm in New York, the Proskauer firm. In later years, I became friendly with George Gallitz, the lawyer who was on the other side. It was formidable. Had a silver tongue. He was beautiful to listen to. Scary, but beautiful. And his young associate, who went around the country with me and took all these depositions, was a guy named David Stern, who is now the commissioner of the NBA. He's the most highly respected sports commissioner in sports today, David Stern.
Oh, my goodness.
And he and I used to say we went to more hotel rooms together to take depositions. But in 1969, when that case was about to go to trial, here in the Western District of Pennsylvania, I got a call one day. I was in my office, and it was David Stern on the phone saying, and they had insisted they would never discuss settlement. They were going to keep Connie out. I got a call saying, Mr. Gallitz is going to call you on Monday. Are you going to be there? And I said, yes. Well, he's going to call you on Monday to discuss possible settlement in this case. My heart flippity-flop.
Two minutes. Okay.
And I said, does settlement include Connie's playing in the NBA? And he said, well, it might. And I went running into David's office, saying all the way from one end of the floor to the other, Mr. Gallitz is going to call me Monday to talk about possible settlement in this case. It was just a wonderful moment.
And they did settle.
They settled, and Connie played in the NBA.
Isn't that wonderful? Do you ever keep in touch with him?
Oh, all the time.
Do you?
He came home for David's funeral.
Did he?
He's come to my kids' weddings.
Is that right?
He's a member of the family.
Isn't that a wonderful story? You have to write a book.
Well, there is a book, Foul, and they're supposed to be making a movie of it.
I read that. But you have to write a book.
Someday.
You will. Yeah. And the other, if we have a minute or two, is you had a case with
Continental Can.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to get these cases on.
Continental Can was a...
Wait, just okay. Let me...
Maybe turn it over.
Let's turn the tape up.